The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For alcoholics, addicts, and people in recovery, the holiday season is a kind of Bermuda Triangle. Those fizzy days of parties and celebration between Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's can plunge even the moderate drinker into a sea of overindulgence. Then on January 1 comes the vow to quit. It is a challenge for anyone, and one that writers from the Roman philosopher Seneca to notorious drinkers like Raymond Carver and Ernest Hemingway have struggled with, some more successfully than others. Neil Steinberg, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Sarah Bader, the creator of the Quotenick website, compile the experience of writers and artists from William Shakespeare to David Foster Wallace to illuminate the process of becoming sober in a new anthology. It's called Out of the Wreck I Rise, a literary companion to recovery. And Neil Steinberg is with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Neil, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Nice to be here.
Now, you read a memoir a couple years ago about bottoming out and getting sober. It was called Drunkard, A Hard Drinking Life. Mm-hmm. Did you look to writers to get you through it?
Absolutely. Recovery can be very confusing. You're lost and alone in this situation, and you want something to sort of guide you. And I remember when I was first in recovery, I was looking to things, songs a lot. There's a wonderful Sarah McLachlan song called Fallen. Which is sort of it was an anthem for me, and there was a line in it it was a simple line, better I should know. And because when you're finding out all these terrible things about yourself and this addiction that you have and you have to master, and you're thinking, oh, why can't I go back? Why can't I just ignore this? And that one line, better I should know, you know, it just reminded me that these are facts and I have to kind of go with it. And that was the genesis of this book, was, you know, I like literature, I like to read, and I would stumble across things that were powerful to me. In Drunkard, I happened to be reading my kid the Aeneid. I would read things out loud. And when I got arrested and went into rehab, the scene I was reading him was where Aeneas is on the island of Circe, where her brew turns men into pigs. And it's kind of hard not to be reading that and having it going on in your life and not see a resonance. And there's a quote in the book from the Aeneid where I say, basically, gather up your courage again and tuna sidi malus, yield not to evils. Now, if you're feeling tempted, if you're going to a party where everyone's drinking but you, it's sort of helpful to say to yourself, yield not to evil, but go forth all the more strong, boldly to face it. I mean, that's a plan. And somehow it helps to have this 2,000-year-old piece of literature telling you that. At least it helped me, and I thought maybe it would help other people.
So don't drink from Circe's cup.
Right, exactly. I mean, this is the thing. The book begins where alcohol is still fun. You know, the opening quote is, all roads lead to the tavern. And I wanted to show people, because that's where your recovery begins. You're in the middle of this, and it's your life. It's what you do. And, people who are sober, it seems that like a zombie cult. It's some other world that has nothing to do with you. And so that's why it was important to me to have kind of started in the middle of the party, which is where this usually starts. And then things slowly go wrong. I mean, the what I'm most proud of the book is it's not so much an anthology as it's a narrative. These quotes are sort of mortised together to form a story. It's, you know, and not only that, but I kind of, you know, people think of as negative as addiction can be, they also view it as romantic. You know, Keith Richards and a heroin addict and all that sort of stuff. There's an edge to it. And I try to argue, Sarah and I argue in this book, that recovery is also heroic, that it's the path of a hero, that you're doing this very difficult thing. You know, it's like climbing a mountain. And there's a lot of mountain imagery in it, a lot of water imagery, a lot of mazes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you have this sort of boozy start to it. Aeneas Nin praising the promise of a martini, Samuel Johnson on the freedom of a tavern. So you begin with the glory of drinking, but then follow the path that many people go through, kind of circling the drain, overcoming denial, taking the plunge in some way, rehab, therapy, AA. There are entries here from John Cheever's journal on how his drinking affected his life and creative life. Ernest Hemingway's letters. Talking about these
people become almost like characters. You know, Cheever was very eloquent and very, and to show you how things kind of click together, there's a moment in his journal where he was saying, it started with this speck of unease and he was late to a train and he met a friend for lunch and had a few more cocktails and the day sort of started to dissolve and he ran into an old friend's wife and did something obscene and he woke up the next day and he wanted to kill himself and he tried to look back and what had started it, and it was just a speck. And then the next quote is from Emily Dickinson from a letter from 75 years earlier where she says, it's the speck that forms the cloud, that causes the storm, that wrecks the ship, children, but nobody fears a speck. Hmm. Do you see how they kind of talk to each other?
Yes.
And when I put those two quotes together, I could almost hear them click. I mean, a lot of it is obvious, but some of it are things you may not have thought of. Like there's a chapter on time.
Hmm.
Now, time is very important in recovery because you have to do the right thing now and today and tomorrow and next week and next year and sort of master. That's why people count their months in the beginning and count their years. And the time, each chapter starts with a quote and is named for the quote. So the time chapter is called Wait. And this is wonderful Galway Connell poem called Wait, where he's saying wait a little. You know, and that's a very important skill in recovery is you really want to go have a drink right now. But you learn that if you just wait, that desire will pass and you'll be in a better position than had you run out and had that drink.
Can you read from that poem? It's just so lovely. Is this where he talks about awakening
absolutely.
To the world?
It's called mm-hmm. Wait for Now. Distrust everything if you have to, but trust the hours. Haven't they carried you everywhere up to now? Personal events will become interesting again. Hair will become interesting. Pain will become interesting. Buds that open out of season will become interesting. And he basically says, and you should be there to experience it and to see it. And the poem ends like this. Wait. Don't go too early. You're tired, but everyone's tired. But no one is tired enough. Only wait a little and listen. Music of hair. Music of pain. Music of looms weaving all of our loves again. Be there to hear it.
Neil Steinberg is with us. He's co-author of Out of the Wreck I Rise. It's a collection of writers, artists, and thinkers on addiction and recovery and essays by the authors about their experience of recovery. You talked about the addiction as illness, and there is a John Berryman quote in the book. Willpower is nothing. Morals is nothing. Lord, this is illness. And I think people understand addiction much more than they did when he killed himself in 1972. But is there still, Neil, a moral component or maybe a judgment of weakness for people who are suffering from addiction?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why people can be so private about this. It's where cancer was 50 years ago. You used to be able to not say it because you were ashamed. And a lot of people are ashamed to talk about this, to say, I'm an alcoholic, I have this problem. And, you know, I was lucky in the sense that my rehab was so public, being a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. I remember checking into the hospital, and then the nurse said, well, of course, your being here is completely confidential. And I said, well, you know, my being here is in the New York Post this morning. So the confidentiality thing, it's not an issue for me. And at the time, it was horrible, but it seemed to be a great blessing, too, because it was, you know, people would say, well, aren't you ashamed to talk about this? And I'd say, you know, I wasn't ashamed to be this notorious sponge reeling around town, soaking up every drop of booze I could get my hands on. Why would I be ashamed that I got better, that I'm trying to help other people get better? I mean, there are many wonderful things about recovery. It really is. It's not the doom. See, the thing is, when you're a drinker, when you're an addict, that's your world. It's who you are. It's what you love. It's what you do. And you have to replace it with something else. And that's what these quotes are really, I mean, you know, poetry is a wonderful thing. And people think of it as all fey and, you know, nothing, something frilly. And it's not. These are powerful things. We have 8 Louise Glick poems in this. And Louise Glick is sort of like this angry, cheesed off septuagenarian. And it's like hitting something with a hammer to read her words.
Well, being an artist, and you have to have some ego, some will, to believe that you have something to say. But you in the book present confronting addiction as kind of suspending that ego and the will, you know, to not see yourself as so distinct or unique, but you're just another alcoholic. There's a quote from Jonathan Franzen, but nothing disturbs the feeling of specialness like the presence of other human beings feeling identically special. So why, Neil, is this so essential to the process, especially for someone like a writer, like yourself?
Well, I mean, and that's something which they hit on in AA very much is that in your addiction, you are the same. And, you know, a person who's an addict, they tend to kind of want to create a realm of exception for themselves. No, I'm not. I mean, it's only three drinks, whatever. They kind of have, they argue it and they use their personality to try to push it back. And a big word in recovery is acceptance. You have to say, I have this problem. I am like these other people. I mean, that's the glory of going to AA meetings is you go, you show up and you're not an alcoholic. You're just going because your wife's making you. And you listen to these people talking about themselves. And you know, it's a syllogism. Is it syllogism? A equals B? In other words, where you say, these people are obviously alcoholics, A. B, I'm just like them. C, I must be an alcoholic too. So you have to kind of be led to the path there. And I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Well, I think that's such an interesting thing with people who make the leap. I think that's the way you put it in the book. There's a whole segment on taking that leap. And breaking that cycle means overcoming denial. Jack London couldn't do it. He was convinced he'd mastered John Barleycorn. Raymond Carver did make it. John Cheever did in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, which he initially dismissed as a bunch of Christers. Is there any clue as to why some are able to get it and stay sober while others are not? You know, either from their writing or your observation.
I think the acceptance that I mentioned, and with Jack London's a fascinating example, because here's a guy who was drinking continually. And he wrote a memoir of it called John Barleycorn that we use in the book. And he basically is able to stop drinking for a week on an ocean voyage, and he uses this to announce that he can't be an alcoholic because he could stop for a week, and therefore he's okay, and he drinks himself to death at it by age 40. And so I do think it's a matter of whether you can honestly look at yourself and what you're doing. And that's why where these writers come in so clearly, you know, so importantly, because to be a good writer, you have to write honestly. You have to look at things clearly. You have to state it boldly. And a lot of these things are stated in a way that I'd never seen them stated before. I didn't quite, and that's really, again, how the book came to be. I'd be reading Seneca, and Seneca would be talking about what disease really is. Hmm. And I'd realize, oh, my God, he's talking about booze. There's a quote from Petrarch in here, Climbing Mount Ventoux, where he's basically talking about his view towards sin, where he's saying, the things I love, I don't love. No, I'm lying. I actually do love them, but I love them in this covert way that I'm fighting against. And, it's a perfect summation for your attitude towards booze or towards your addictive substance, where you still love the thing, but you're rebelling against that love. And I didn't quite, and again, hopefully with these quotes, it's not just things that are powerful and you can carry in your pocket and pull out and help you, but things that will help understand that once you read them, you'll go, yes, that's exactly it.
Hmm. Well, we do move from the harrowing, we've got Ernest Hemingway. This is from an unpublished draft of The Sun Also Rises. There was nothing to do but drink. Each day became a replica of the day before. This kind of relentlessness to stories of people like Raymond Carver, who famously, he's a real inspiration, I think, here in this narrative, that he got the gravy, recovery, the gravy. What did that mean for him? When as an artist and a writer, so much of their identity is tied up in that. So what happens when you've changed and become someone else, a new person, as one of the writers?
That Carver poem, we call the last chapter Gravy, and it's a beautiful poem that he wrote about the last 10 years of his life. Let me read a little bit of it, the beginning of it to you, because it sort of sums it up. It begins, no other word will do, for that's what it was, gravy. Gravy these past 10 years, alive, sober, working, loving, and being loved by a good woman. 11 years ago, he was told he had 6 months to live at the rate he was going, and he was going nowhere but down. So he changed his ways somehow. And that's really what the book is about. You can change. You can do things differently. You can be a different person. It is possible. Other people have done it, and you can too.
Neil Steinberg, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, memoirist, and co-author with Sarah Bader of Out of the Wreck I Rise, A Literary Companion to Recovery. Neil, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Virginia, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
There's much more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
I don't want a lot of.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the holiday season, and like the striking of a clock, Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You is once again everywhere and firmly planted in the Billboard Top 40. Released in 1994, the song has become a classic. And my guest argues that not only does it deserve to be topping the charts, but has earned a place in the Great American Songbook. Adam Ragusa teaches journalism at Mercer University. He also hosts The Pub. That's a podcast for the public broadcasting publication Current. And Adam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me, Virginia.
Okay, Adam, you say this deserves a place in the Great American Songbook, which makes me think of Cole Porter or George Gershwin or Irving Berlin or something like that. Not even a good pop song. So what's the distinction there?
Well, when you look at the popular music of the early part of the 20th century, it is primarily a style of music that is coming out of jazz more than anything else. It's also very informed by the classical tradition and the music theater tradition, musical comedy. But it's primarily coming from jazz. And then this big thing happens, rock and roll happens in the middle of the 20th century. And then from that point onward, popular music tends to be primarily inspired by rock and roll. If we look at the differences between jazz and rock and roll, there are many. But the one that I think is particularly relevant to understanding this Mariah Carey song is that jazz-influenced popular music has lots and lots of chords, just lots of chords, a much bigger, broader harmonic palette. Whereas one of the distinguishing features of rock and roll was harmonic simplicity, three-chord songs, four-chord songs, and not just a small number of chords at play in any given song, but very, very simple chords at play in any given song, right? So this sort of funny thing happened to pop songs in the middle of the 20th century, where in the first half, they tended to have these very rich harmonic palettes, lots and lots of chords. And then in the second half, it tends to get a whole lot more simple. And I don't think that's bad, by the way. There's, you know, I love all kinds of popular music from across the entire century. But it just is, right? And one of the things that I like about All I Want for Christmas Is You is that harmonically, it's right out of the first half of the 20th century. There are 13 different chords that I have counted in my little back of the envelope harmonic analysis of this thing, which is just a lot more than you would see in a rock and roll influenced pop song. And there's also specific flavors of chords that you just don't hear in contemporary music much these days, particularly diminished chords. There's this wonderful diminished seventh chord that I think is just the most Christmassy chord that I've ever heard. And part of that is because it's a chord that actually occurs in one of the most famous early 20th century Christmas songs, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, which is one of the classic Irving Berlin songs. And in fact, I can go ahead and play that for you here if you'd like. Before anyone judges my piano playing, I'm playing on an iPhone, okay? It's not easy. All right. So Mariah Carey's song starts here on a home chord, tonic chord. I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. Goes to a four chord. I don't care about the presents. And here's our special chord, our diminished chord. Underneath the Christmas tree, I just want you for my own, right? Okay, that little spicy half-diminished 7-2 chord. That little spicy half-diminished 2-7 chord. Love that chord, and we hear it the exact same way in Irving Berlin's tune where he goes, when the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow, right? Okay.
Oh, yeah, I feel toastier and cozier.
Yeah. It's like mulled cider with a little bit of bourbon thrown in for good measure, right? It's not the kids' Christmas. It's the Christmas that the adults are having after the kids have gone to bed. These are adult chords.
So I'm not sure that I could have picked out these half diminished sevenths, as you said, but there is a feeling there. The adult Christmas chord, I guess we'll call it for right now, although that sounds a little bit nasty.
I think that I love nasty.
Well, how does Mariah's vocal performance contribute to this, what you think is classic feel? I mean, the song does not seem to have her typical vocal acrobatics, you know, miasma, I think they call it.
I think the word you're looking for is melisma. miasma was the fog that the medieval Europeans thought caused the plague. But that's pretty funny when you—it's pretty funny when you think about it that way, because I think a lot of people regard the influx of, like, you know, nonstop AM radio Christmas channels around this time of year to be a kind of miasma. So I like where you're going there, Virginia. But anywho, so yeah, there's a couple of things going on here with Carrie's performance and the broader arrangement. Although I think that harmonically, the song is very much inspired by that kind of classic early 20th century popular music. In terms of every other aspect of the song, its arrangement, its melody, the rhythm, everything else is directly inspired by a 1972 record by Phil Spector called A Christmas Gift From Me to You. And in particular, a song on there called Christmas. Great title. I think it has a subtitle of Baby, Please Come Home. And that's one that, you know, as soon as people hear it right now, they'll recognize it.
Let's just hear that now. So yeah, Phil Spector's wall of sound. Is that what you think they were going for with the Mariah Carey song?
Oh yeah, that is the explicit cultural reference that Mariah Carey's song is making. I doubt that she or her co-writer really intended to kind of be alluding to Irving Berlin. I think that's just something that they probably did subconsciously. And there's some debate as to how that happened. Both Mariah Carey and her co-writer have been interviewed several times about the composition of this song. And the way they tell the story, Carey kind of came in with that melody. You know, she didn't have any chords behind it or anything like that. She just had the melody. And so she sat with him at the piano and he wrote some chords to it and they finished the song. However, you can tell that her melody arpeggiates up and down chords. That means just sort of singing up and down the notes of the chord rather than singing in the notes in between the chords. So she's outlining the chords with the melody. So I think that we can probably credit Mariah Carey to a great extent with the harmonic structure of this song. So I think that was subconscious, that kind of callback to those kind of Irving Berlin chords. What they were going for, what they went in there with the intention of doing, was doing a Phil Spector style Christmas song. And it's funny is that Phil Spector, with that 1972 record, was himself trying to be retro and call back to something older, specifically Motown versions of Christmas songs from the 60s, like when the Jackson 5 did Santa Claus is Coming to Town. That's the kind of vibe he was going after.
Santa Claus is coming.
I don't know. You must do this when you're wheeling your cart around at Target, thinking about what's happening with the music that's playing. I don't know if
sure,
everybody
yeah.
does. But how about that thought? I feel like I am more drawn to the more melancholy Christmas fare. Maybe as you're talking, I'm realizing it's because that was the music that my mother was playing. You know, she was playing Perry Como. We were playing the Jackson 5 when we were kids. And maybe I just started getting cynical about Christmas by the time All I Want for Christmas rolled around.
Oh, why would you ever be cynical about Christmas?
Oh, okay. Cynical must not be the right word.
No, being cynical is the proper reaction to have to the way that contemporary Americans celebrate the holiday of Christmas. I don't think you have anything to feel bad about right there. No, without a doubt, Mariah Carey's song is a piece of bubblegum fluff. It does not have a lot of depth to it in any direction except for harmonically. It's got cool chords, and that's all I'm trying to get people to appreciate.
So our next guest is going to be defending Paul McCartney's and Wings' Wonderful Christmas Time. Where do you stand on that one?
Yes. No, 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 no. Take the station off the air right now.
Okay, Adam, if you say so. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Adam Ragusea teaches journalism at Mercer University, and he's also host of The Pub. That's one of our favorite podcasts. That's for the public broadcasting publication Current. You'll find a link to read his article, All I Want for Christmas is Diminished Chords, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. So we heard Adam Ragusea going to bat for Mariah Carey, but this is a bridge too far.
The mood is right, the spirit's up, we're here tonight.
And that's enough. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
From those first unmistakable synthy beats, few seasonal songs divide people as much as Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time. But why? And will anyone stand up for the schlocky 1979 single? It turns out, yes. Annie Zaleski is a freelance journalist and contributing writer at the AV Club. We found her article in defense of Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time on Salon. And Annie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm just going to tell you what our other guest, Adam Ragusa, said when I told him you were going to defend this song. He said, no, 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 no. Well, critics like to remind us that this song lacks nuance, pretty much lyrics, and is confused about what genre it wants to be. But it's still a really popular Christmas song. What is it that people so dislike about it?
You know, I think part of it is that, you know, it's Paul McCartney. You know, he was in the Beatles. So people have certain expectations for him. You know, they kind of expect greatness, to be very honest, because he was great for so long. And this is it, as you're right, this song was such a departure for him. I mean, it was 1979. He was kind of getting into synthesizer technology, which was very different and very new at the time. And so he was kind of, you know, basically figuring it out. And so the song has a lot of experimentation. It's a very different sound for him. So I think a lot of people were also sort of taken aback by what is going on here. You know, there's no guitars, you know, there's no, you know, piano. This is definitely not the Paul that we know and love.
So make your case for Wonderful Christmas Time. What do you think people are not getting about this song?
You know, I think it's, well, first off, the experimentation of it, I like that it's different. You know, Paul at the time, you know, Wings was kind of winding down. Paul was about ready to launch a solo career. And it was neat hearing him kind of get with the times and explore contemporary sounds. So in that sense, I really appreciate it because he actually, I think, did that in a very successful way. He was sort of presaging where he was going next. Second off, you know, it's sentimental. You know, I am firmly in the camp that I like Paul McCartney's sentimental songs. And I know that is a very divisive topic as well. And it's, you know, it's joyous. There is, you know, this song is very joyous. There's no real, you know, conflict to it. You know, you're not thinking too hard about it. It's basically just saying, hey, I want you to have a good holiday. Let's have a wonderful Christmas time. I can't resist that.
So what was going on musically in 1979? If you can kind of place it in context with us, I'm thinking new wave, skinny ties.
That's absolutely it. So in 1979, synthesizers and keyboards were starting to get a little bit more affordable and a little bit more mainstream. So that year, especially in the UK, there were some music hits that were using it, M and Gary Numan and things like that. And so Paul was sort of fascinated by that. You know, Paul was always sort of a restless, creative person. So he was sort of exploring, like, how could I merge what my songwriting with this new technology. So, you know, I think I hear this song and to me it just screams late 70s because it's just, you know, this synthesizer, it's very simple. It's not necessarily very complex, but there's something kind of charming about it. And all of the music around that time that was using keyboards was very much like that. You know, it was definitely, they were kind of figuring things out as they went along. And so that made for some really interesting music.
So it does sound dated, but really, if you think about it, most Christmas songs are dated. Isn't that why we like them, for the nostalgia?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, this song is so nostalgic. You know, it's sort of, even then, when it came out in 1979, it seemed nostalgic for a time that didn't exist, despite the fact that the music was very contemporary sounding. You know, I mean, things, you know, in the world, there were definitely some conflicts that were going on. England had a very tough few years by the time 1979 rolled around. And this song was sort of a throwback to a time when, you know, things weren't necessarily complicated and things were just sort of, you know, you were just looking forward to having some holiday Christmas dinner with your family, opening a few gifts and just kind of enjoying the holiday and not worrying about things. And so in that sense, this song is sort of a throwback to, you know, all of the nostalgic, you know, simple, fun songs that we probably enjoyed as kids growing up.
Annie, I think you've redeemed it to some degree. Thank you for speaking with us.
Absolutely. I've done my job.
Annie Zaleski, a freelance journalist. She's written for the AV Club and Spin Magazine, among others. And we read her article in defense of Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time at Salon. You'll find a link to read it yourself and take a listen to Wonderful Christmas Time, maybe anew, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Let us know if either of our guest defenders of Christmas pop songs convinced you to rethink Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You or Paul McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time. Maybe just a little, or if the respective discussions planted the earworms more deeply into your holiday music hate. You tell us. We're at Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. Musical debates are so much more nuanced when shared by word of mouth. Our thanks to Jazar, Poddington Bear, Franco Luzzi, and Jason Leonard for music on this episode. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.